We stopped at...
Gary's voice carries.
Huh?
Your voice carries.
Does it?
Yeah, I can hear you all the way down.
Oh, good. Oh, even when we're sitting here?
When I first came up.
Oh. I worked on it carrying.
You have?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, when you're speaking publicly, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Mina. Carol, you want to give us a little report?
Well, I brought this painting today because I felt that this scenario described it so accurately, except for one little detail. So if you go to that right-hand column in the paragraph that starts, Elijah climbs before me into the heights, and he says, this place is a vessel that collects the light of the sun. Well, here in the painting, here's the vessel. We're still on page 251.
Okay.
Okay, and then the paragraph that starts, Elijah climbs before me. That's like halfway down.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay. And at the end of that paragraph, it says, this place is a vessel that collects the light of the sun. And here in the painting, we have this place is a vessel that collects the light of the moon. So that's, and Gary made a comment, he said, well, perhaps today we have to collect the light of the moon as opposed to the light of the sun. And then he goes on to say in the next paragraph, the collective light becomes water. And here also, the collective light becomes water in the painting. And then he says, it goes down a crevice into a dark cave. And this goes down the crevices into the dark cave, which is the female figure. And he says, a wonderful flood of sunlight surrounds everything, which is also true in the painting. So it's as though this whole scenario that he has must be somehow archetypal and you know, and it makes me wonder where it's been in history before. It was popped up now. I would say I created this image by what I call the numinous experience of the object. So, you know, I go about my daily business and an object grabs me, and then I know it wants to be placed in a painting. And I go about collecting those objects, and somehow they all seem to make a composition. You know, the unconscious is planning it that way, and then it turns into a painting. So I'll just pass this around.
Be careful if you're following Carol at Kroger's.
What?
Said, be careful if you're following Carol at Kroger's. You have a numinous can of beans all over.
You know, you're pretty close to the truth.
That's a new... It reminds me, I was at CVS or someplace, and there was a woman with a little... Girl might have been about four. And speaking of numinous experience of the object, and her mom was filling out all these coupons, you know, to send her photographs off. And the little girl said, Mommy, I want a color too. She thought she was coloring, you know. So that child ability just to perceive in each moment a chance of a play and immediate relationship. Okay, back to Mimi. Well, as Carol said, water is collected. Light is collected and becomes water, which is a well. I think that's the key thing here. That's the source of ideas. And the more struggle, I can't reach down, I lose courage. A little farther down, solitary and deathly silent here.
When the light comes down, this is the light of consciousness coming down. It's the inner light of the image of the spirit provides.
I think so. Right. It's insight. A pool of insight waiting to be brought to consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So that man's trapped on in the earth. Right? There's the man trapped in the earth.
Yeah. In my imagination, he's released those two doves. Formerly doves were white, but now they're black and white in that image. And you see, he's almost like the passing image of the Anthropos syndrome of the formal image of the Anthropos as Christ sinking back into the earth.
And that earth has dried up, right?
Mm-hmm.
That used to be the well. That was the well.
That was the well, but it's all dry now and cracked and punched.
Mm-hmm.
And where's the water? And the new water is
going into the feminine.
Yeah, going into that feminine figure who is also a cave.
So that could be part of that could be six.
Of what?
That figure in the desert, down in the
desert. I see. Yeah, yeah. And the doves would be like the well. Would you think? Something's being released.
Message.
Their
insight. That's what I mean.
Yeah, that's.
There are wisdom. There are wisdom that's both dark and light together.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I don't know.
Like the serpent.
Yes.
It's almost as if he releases his spirit then to go to the new.
As though, you know, the transition is happening or something is being passed on to the other one.
Right, because Jung said that we don't just get rid of Christianity, correct? There are things in it that are very positive that we have to move forward.
Right, so that'd be like the essence, whatever that essence is that has to be passed on.
Mm-hmm.
Flying up to her.
Yeah.
Flying over to
the new cave.
Mm-hmm.
The new well.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, as always. Another page.
Huh? 52 or 52?
We did 252, didn't we? What am I doing?
You're just anxious, Gary.
Oh my God, I skipped the most important part.
Slow down a little bit.
Apologies. I think we can skip that first section on the left column on 252. Other than to note a serpent appears top of 252. Now this is where it picks up. Let's go very close, carefully. A wreath of fire shines around the stone. I am seized with fear at what I see. The coarse peasant's boot, the foot of a giant that crushes an entire city. Is it here? I think later that's described as the coarse peasant's boot is a reference to a possible German peasant's revolt. And I don't think it's that important for our purposes. The foot of a giant that crushes an entire city, I think that giant would be the war. I see the cross, the removal of the cross, the mourning. So Christianity is losing its power. How agonizing this sight is. No longer do I yearn. I see the divine child with the white serpent in his right hand and the black serpent in his left hand. I see the green mountain the cross of Christ on it, and a stream of blood flowing from the summit of the mountain. I can no longer... It is unbearable. I see the cross and Christ on it in his last hour of torment. What we're going to see down the road is Jung is saying, since Christianity has died, we have to suffer Christ's torment. I think that's what it's foreshadowing.
Suffer Christ's what?
Torment. In other words, that the crucifixion on the opposites becomes our challenge once Christ has died.
And that's our image here, I think.
Yes.
That he's describing right now.
Yes. No, he's getting there anyway. But we'll see, it's a slightly different kind of crucifixion. Snake is doing it. At the foot of the cross, the black serpent coils itself. Now it starts. Has wound itself around my feet. I am held fast and I spread my arms wide. I understand that black serpent to be Salome. Well, let's see if that's right. So he's letting the erotic now squeeze him. I spread my arms wide. Salome draws near. The serpent has wound itself around my whole body, and my countenance is that of a lion. I think that's the most important sentence in the whole thing up to now. Maybe we can just stop there and interpret it for a minute. As I say, we'll go back to his commentary, but so that we don't digest too many images without some understanding.
Could we go back just above that paragraph that you just read, where Elijah says, "How impetuous you are, what is up with you? Step over the crystal and prepare yourself in its light." Remember the image where he's in the cave, and there's the dragon and the dragonfly, and there's that red crystal. Is this that same crystal, you think? We're seeing it again. Do you remember that image?
Yes, I think it is, because I don't know if we'll get to it today, but there's a reference back to that image coming up.
Okay.
And it's also the crystal in the house of Elijah, too. Right?
Remind me.
In Elijah's house, there's a big crystal in that room that they go to.
Do you know what page?
Fire. Okay. But prior in our meeting, there was a big crystal in his house, and they went in there, and he looks into it.
Okay.
Remember?
No, I don't.
Do you remember?
Yeah. You want to look for it?
Okay.
I got the book here. Or you want to look for it in your stuff, or...
Assuming they're all the same crystal, sort of transforming into...
I think so, but I wanted just to hear it before I reacted. Why don't you make yourself a note, and we'll revisit this next time. How's that?
Okay.
Because we're going to get to a reference to the crystal Kathy mentioned coming up. I'll make myself a note if I don't forget. Because wasn't the crystal the one with It, where the hero was floating dead, right? That's what you're referring to. That's what you're referring
to.
It was the one before that. It's the image before that, where he first descends into hell. It's the descent into hell.
Yeah, look into the crystal, and behind it is the opening.
I'm talking about the one where the dragonfly and the dragon.
Right. And behind that crystal in that cave where the dragonfly is the entrance to that vision.
Right. He goes in to that, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not that one, the one
I thought you were thinking of this
one. No, the one
before. Did I go past it?
Yes. One more. There. There's a crystal over here on the right. I don't know if
somebody can you kill that light?
Yeah.
See the red crystal? And then it's being guarded by the dragon.
Can you point it out?
The crystal? It's right there.
You see it?
And that's different than the sun?
That's not the sun.
Not the same, huh?
No. That, he enters some opening behind that crystal.
Right.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then he goes into the area where he has this vision.
Right.
This is the area behind that.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking the sun and the crystal were similar.
They could be.
We're just talking about how he describes going from one to the other.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because then this would mean that what we're dealing with now is the resolution of this imagery here. I'll do a little reflection on that.
And then thinking that of Mime, you know, taking Siegfried into the cave, and there is Jung in the cave with the dragon, and that's what Siegfried is supposed to kill, is the dragon who has the gold.
Would the red crystal be analogous then to alchemical as being dissolved?
Let me review this and give you a better answer than just trying to guess. I'm thinking that the crystal is what we've come to, you know, this whole transformation of Jung into the lion's head. But let me do a little homework on that so I can draw a better thread. Okay. Serpent has wound itself around my whole body, and my countenance is that of a lion. He becomes Ion. Does that make sense if I put it like that to everybody? Some people are not nodding their head. No, doesn't make sense. Okay. I think it's so important because this is the first concrete image of what will later become Jungian psychology. That's why I think it's so important. Jung's psychology is not just an attempt to heal individuals in therapy. It's an attempt to heal individuals in therapy in a way that is a response to the nature of the times. What does that mean? Well, that's Ion. What does Jung do in Ion? Very briefly, he divides Western history up into two periods, from the birth of Christ to 1000 and from 1000 to now. This is very basic. It's a little more detailed than this, but and then from now to 3000, anticipating. So you can really say three, except we're at the juncture between the second and third. The first 1,000 years was dominated by a Christian psychology, which means the spirit was separated from matter. Spirituality was something reaching up, and everything that was down was bad. Materiality is bad, spirituality is good. That was a pendulum swing. And at 1000 AD, it had gone as far as it could go, and it started to swing back, where materiality became the dominant theme of Western history. The Renaissance, the Scientific Revolution, the Enlightenment, Age of Exploration, Materialism, Industrial Revolution, Capitalism. The thrust of Western history in the last 1,000 years was actually, in fact, a reversal of all the spiritual values of the first 1,000 years. The reason the book is called Ion is because it's the Greek for long period of time. So he's analyzing history in terms of long periods of time. Ion is also the name of the Mithraic god who represents long period of time. In Greek, you know, they have three words for time: Chronos, tick, tick, tick; Kairos, the quality between the ticks; and Ion is the third Greek word for time, meaning a long period of time characterized by a particular theme. We don't even have that word in English in its original sense. So an Ion just isn't, you know, 500 years. It's 500 years that have a specific quality about them. So in his book Ion, he tries to understand Western history as comprised up to now these two theme-based periods. Which brings us to today. We've gone from spirituality to materiality. Now we have to synthesize the two. Siegfried, you might say, was the materiality, power, accomplishment. That reached its destructive apex in two world wars. And I'm going to say those two world wars were the logical conclusion of the 2,000 years that preceded it. Jung didn't think those wars were an accident. We were built to self-destruct. But now we are in a position to reevaluate everything and to turn back to the material. When I say material, I mean instinctual, the desire. See, that's Salome. And to understand through our passionate commitment to the world the insights that are trying to come to us. That's Elijah. So Jungian psychology is an attempt to solve that problem by understanding the historical nature of our present epoch in time, and that's what's coming to him as his face turns into the face of a lion. He's becoming Ion. And he is achieving, or he's being prepared to achieve, the insight that his psychology has to accurately reflect what we need to do now to solve our Western psychological problem of spirituality becoming materiality. Now a synthesis is required. He got all of that, you see, through accepting his Eros for Tony Wolf. Tony Wolf, for him, was a place where materiality led to the spirit. It wasn't purely spiritual. It wasn't purely material. It was a material experience that led to insight. that's a solution to the split between spirit and matter that's characterized our time, our civilization, really. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
So all of that stuff he's been going through, I think, is driving this image home to him that he has to be concerned with psychology and history together. Salome says, Mary was the mother of Christ, do you understand? I see that a terrible and incomprehensible power forces me to imitate the Lord in his final torment, but how can I presume to call Mary my mother? You are Christ, she says. I stand with outstretched arms like someone crucified, my body taut, and horribly entwined by the serpent. You, Salome, say that I am Christ. Let's look at the footnote. Very important. What he says there is that he speaks back to Salome and he says, you're crazy. Oh, I said, this is madness. See the very first line. In the 1925 seminar, Jung recounted that after Salome's declaration that he was Christ, in spite of my objection, she maintained this. I said, this is madness. You see what's going on.
He's trying to separate himself out from the from the symbolic versus the concrete of the interpretation of his experience.
Exactly. So in other words, what happens, apparently, you see, God is dead here. There's no living relationship with the old understanding of God. And instead of turning to God for guidance, he turns to his desire. And within his desire, he finds guidance. That is to say, he becomes Ion. And Ion is the foundation of his psychology. And he becomes Christ insofar as he lets himself be crucified. And out of that crucifixion, that is, out of enduring the conflict between Salome and Elijah, desire and forethinking, a new birth occurs. That new birth is Jungian psychology. That brings with it a terrific danger of inflation. That you think you have solved it, rather than realizing the solution has been given to you. Salome, on the one hand, is his salvation, and on the other hand, she's trying to make him psychotic. Because if he believed he was Christ, he would be psychotic. Maybe that's where he got the idea I may have mentioned. When he would see two people in the psychiatric hospital who thought they were Christ, he'd sit them down at a table together for a cup of coffee. He avoided that danger by speaking back to that animal. But all of this goes together. The desire, the insight, history, the birth of a new understanding, and the horrific danger of inflation. But I think that serpent is the eros he had for Tony Wolf. That is Salome. Without that, he would not have been squeezed sufficiently to generate. So that's his crucifixion. It is as if I stood alone on a high mountain with stiff, outstretched arms. See the crucifixion. The serpent squeezes my body in its terrible coils, and the blood streams from my body, spilling down the mountainside. So his cross isn't, he's not crucified by nails in his hands, he's crucified by a serpent. That's what binds him to the cross. His eroticism is what's crucifying. And that's what that is. Yeah. See, that could only happen if he were moral. Because he knows he's being driven to harm the feelings of other people in order to create. And it's tormenting him. Where, I don't know, do you see the movie, was it, who was Diego Rivera's paramour? Frida Kahlo, the movie with Frida, how he just was cavalier about his sex encounters. So that's an immoral stance. Here is a man suffering over what he realizes he has to do. Because as soon as you talk about this in public, people think you mean to be like Diego Rivera. And this is much different. But it's carrying that tension, and then out of that suffering, a new point of view is born. So I think that's why it's so important we've gone through all this forethinking, Salome, all that stuff, because here it's being culminated in that producing a new point of view in him. Why that would be the point of view that is produced, I don't know. But that's what's going on. Okay. The serpent squeezes my body in its terrible coils, and the blood streams from my body, spilling down the mountainside. So you see, he's Christ here in the sense that he's being crucified. Salome bends down to my feet and wraps her black hair around them. She lies thus for a long time. Then she cries, "I see light." Truly, she sees, her eyes are open. What do you make of that? Yeah. He had been driven by sexual desires, and now he's getting some insight. If you'll pardon my language, in common parlance, he'd been thinking with his dick. And now he's beginning to think apart from that. So when we get into the same erotic messes time and time again, it's because the anima or the animus doesn't see. And he not only is giving birth to Jungian psychology, his birthing Jungian psychology heals his anima problem, his blind anima, his promiscuous sexuality. Serpent falls from my body and lies languidly on the ground. So see, that eros as the snake is much less compulsive. It's not pressing him anymore. But if we go back to that footnote again, 2:11, go down 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down. You cannot get conscious of these unconscious facts without giving yourself to them. So that he had to go the route of Eros in order to free himself from it with the birth of Jungian psychology. That's the sacrifice. Sacrifice is no longer not going with instinct. It is, in fact, the sacrifice to go with instinct and suffer the consequences.
And it was they, not just him. He and Tony decided that.
Keep going.
Well, what you gave us to read in there.
Oh.
Talking about her.
Yeah.
She was on the cross too.
She was on the cross too.
Yeah.
In fact, that may be a point. Oh, look at that text. Let's look at that.
That's so powerful. Thank you.
This is from Vanderpost's book. If you don't know it, it's a good Christmas present to yourself. Young in the Story of Our Time. And he's the only one I know who has talked about this in a sympathetic way. Not exactly where we were, and you know, what I'm giving you is simply my opinion, but it really heartened me to have come across his work. It's pretty similar after I reach my own conclusions. So it lets me feel I may not be completely off here. I had you read especially 167 to 177, but I included a few extra pages just because, we don't have to go through it here, but he talks about Jung telling him about the very things we're discussing, you know, the trip by train where he saw the blood, that was 157. Something, a quote I particularly like on 158. Jung talks that he had the feeling that nothing had happened to me which was not, in a sense, also happening to the life of my time, and that more than ever I was to investigate the link between the two levels of experience. This is what we've been talking about, but he just puts it so well. See, 158, the go up, not the very last paragraph, not the one above it, but the last line of lines of the paragraph above that.
Oh, the one you have on. Okay.
So again, it leads me to think I'm not too far off saying that Ion and history, this is the birth of Jung's historical awareness. That inner psychology and outer history, that's our task now, to see how history is coming out of our own complexes. So you might see our task now is to say who's the Islamic fundamentalist in us, and so on. He mentions the rejected feminine on 161. These are just points I like, but 165. He talks about Siegfried in the same way we have, so nothing new there. 167 is where I think he starts on the serpent. The serpent had proved, see, I am middle of the page of 167. The serpent proved that he, Jung, had reestablished contact with his deepest instinctual self. That's Salome. Because that is the image the much persecuted and reviled snake has been compelled to bear, and in consequence was to be cruelly, ruthlessly punished for it in the spirit of man as well as in the world at most times and places. Yet if considered with all the positive and compensatory associations attached to snakes, Jung stood there in the presence of the vital element that would assist in healing the rift within himself and his time. Always himself and his time. All these latter associations explain why the snake to this day is curled as a badge of healing around the Hippocratic staff of medicine. But what of Salome? Jung confesses that he considered her in all her biblical and other aspects, but does not say what they were. Well, I've tried to speculate. Vanderpost speculates, and I think we are more or less in a similar arena. He only hints that she is an image of the Eros, the principle of love and feeling values of life, before abandoning her undeveloped. 168, second paragraph. I believe that it is no accident that Salome was so young, beautiful, and blind, and no idle chance that called her Salome. It is true, as Jung says, that such relationships are perfectly blah, blah, blah. little farther down, for him to say that Salome was blind because the anima is incapable of seeing the meaning of things is another way of confessing that he himself could not see the meaning of Salome, meaning the meaning of what his eros was pulling him into at the point when Salome was blind. In the last paragraph, fourth line. So there then is this urgent warning implicit in the blindness of Salome, indicating that unless she is made to see in time, Jung's own venture is doomed. Despite the healing presence of the snake and the protective wisdom of Philemon, Elijah, the same. I believe, unaided and alone as he had been in this protracted self-analysis of his, skip a little bit, he would have come to the top of 169 to a point where not only could he go no further without help from someone else from without, but was in danger of failing the task he had set himself. The deranged feminine, you see why it's deranged, feminine had done its work, a guide of a positive and integrated feminine self with eyes wide open and alerted was needed through what had to follow. This conclusion, of course, is purely my own reading of the situation. Skip paragraph. But at this blind Salome moment in Jung, there were two who stood out far and above the rest. There was, of course, his own beautiful and extraordinarily gifted wife, Emma, engaged as she was at this moment not only with the bringing up of a family of five, but the wife also to a great man, involved in the battle of a lifetime with himself. She hardly had the space and time to give Jung the kind of help he needed at this point. And even if she had possessed the time at that specific moment, she did not as yet possess the necessary qualifications. She had never been a patient of his, nor did she ever need to be of him or any other man. Happily, however, there was another woman who was a close friend and possessed all the necessary qualifications. That was Toni Wolff, to whom I referred earlier, and with whom my wife studied and worked in Zurich. Skip a couple of sentences. His gift inflicted a special, see where I am? Mm-hmm. His gift inflicted a special form of loneliness on him that was part of an overwhelming compulsion to serve a cause of universal meaning. The cause always had to come before men and women. I have known numbers afflicted likewise, soldiers, statesmen, writers, and artists who have had to set a cause or work before human relationships. Next paragraph, go down three lines. Jung still gave so freely, warmly, compassionately, and generously of himself to friends, family, friends, and fellow sufferers. Skip a couple of lines. Yet he was not allowed to pause or stay to nurse their wounds and comfort them as he longed to do, but had to move on into the deeper battle if it were ever to be won. Let's go to 172, last paragraph. As for Toni Wolff, the woman who was his companion, she was a great and rare spirit, one of the few patricians and certainly the truest in Jung's immediate company of collaborators, and it's 2:30. We'll pick up with that next time, maybe, and we've got the basic idea, I think, now. Snake, Eros, pressing on him, he accepted that problem. It caused him enormous suffering, knowing the harm it was causing, also causing others, namely his wife and family. Yet out of that necessary identification with his own libido, he is transformed and given the foundation of Jungian psychology, which is a historical awareness of what is needed at this time and a psychology that does justice to it. He then lived that out through his relationship with Toni Wolff, as Vander Post said, and I always felt. And we'll talk more next time about what it cost Toni Wolff, and then we'll come back to the second part of the visions, where not only is Salome given sight, but Elijah turns into a burst of light. Okay? We are done for today.
Could I ask one question?
Yeah.
On 169, where it talks about his wife, about her not possessing the necessary qualifications.
Yeah.
And then she says, it says she had never been a patient of his, nor did she ever need to be of him or any other man, meaning that she was more of a, if you look, Tony looks on different types of women, more of an Amazon woman who was of her own ilk, or I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I'm not sure that's even right.
The one who is not needing a man, and yet Tony Wolf.
No, I think what he was saying was, you know, Tony Wolf got into analysis because she was in a mess.
Okay.
Because she was in analysis with Jung, she could understand Jungian psychology. She could understand enough of the psyche to work with Jung. I think he's saying Emma Jung never did a full analysis with somebody because she wasn't messed up.
Okay. And she had five kids.
And yeah, but she then eventually became an analyst.
Yeah.
I think that sentence is a little ambiguous.
Yeah, to be of him or any other man. Sounds like she was a very independent woman.
But she must have had enough analytic experience either with him indirectly or with others that he had trained to learn the craft of doing analysis. Because she herself was an analyst.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what he's saying is she didn't come to it out of a personal crisis like Tony Wolf did.
Well,
I think that's what he's getting at.
She and Tony were in some kind of counseling together.
Yeah, with the guy I worked with.
Mark.
Yeah.
And that's who published her works after Tony's work.
Right, right. So it's not. I don't think it's quite accurate to say she had no analytic experience as an analysand. But I think what he's getting...
I wasn't reading it that way at all. I was reading it more as her own personality as a female type, a feminine type, was that need of another man. You're taking it from analysis...
I think it's referring to the analytic process, not about...
Okay.
Yeah. And...
I was kind of baffled with that, too, and I was wondering which way, from what angle...
That's what I understood. What page is it again?
It's on 169.
I'm sure it's...
Maybe because it's tied into the first part of the sentence saying she had never been a patient. Well, you know, at one point, Gary, you talked about how she was the stronger personality of the two. And that's what I was remembering, and I'm thinking, well, okay... she didn't need to be a patient of him or any other man, because she was so strong already, maybe so comprehensive already, that she certainly got
more comprehensive going through what she did.
But she just never really...
Oh, you can learn it from books.
Well, it's
ambiguous. Here's where I go with it, that her interest in Jungian psychology didn't come from her need to be a patient like Tony Wolf did.
Right.
That she still sought personal analytic experience, probably told Carl her dreams. It wasn't a patient doctor relationship. I know she worked with Meyer. He told me that. But not going into therapy in despair as Tony Wolf did. That's what I'd get.
She went into it for another reason, just to grow.
I would say to grow, to...
she had it all around her.
And she had it all around her, and I think was probably called to grow by her own fate. Remember in that picture, on the picture where he shoots Siegfried, the commentary, he says, I'm out there with my wife. So she was with him too, but not as a patient, more as a collaborator, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Tony Wolf took over the collaborator role for 10 or 15 years, and then I think it went back to his wife. But his wife apparently didn't have the imagination required to get him through what he was going through. That's how I understand it, for what it's worth.
That's a little nice.
Okay, Soho.
Okay, go ahead.
Kicking us out.
Well, we've worked hard enough for one day.
Go find your own day.